Coming up on Weekend America.
In San Quentin Prison, this weekend is a time for freedom.
Like being reborn. Literally, the songs, the prayers, the stages of life that we attend. It's a beautiful ceremony.
Prison lifers are getting some spiritual time off. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. You could complain about mosquitoes this weekend, or you could do something.
Roll myself in DEET and wear like a long linen caftan or muumuu, perhaps.
Sounds perfect.
Okay.
You know, maybe a pith helmet with a net.
Ooh, there you go.
And a new waterfall just opened in Manhattan. You didn't know about it?
One of the reasons why I did not want a big celebration is that I didn't want to make an unnecessary spectacle about it. It's not about the moment you turn it on. It's about the life of the waterfall. It's about the time it takes for the waterfall to kind of become a part of people's memory.
Jump into Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. This weekend, Tyrus Wong is flying kites that are so elaborate and gorgeous, they're going to enthrall strangers who are anywhere nearby, even our reporter, Chrissy Clark. Later this hour, Chrissy will take us soaring over a Southern California beach. So hang on tight. What is a good place to fly a kite in your town?
I'm from Lake Placid, New York, and the best place is to go down by Mirror Lake. There's a great beach there to fly kites at.
Oh, I actually would go to the beach.
When I was young, I used to make my own kite and fly it. It was in Asia, Cambodia. You tie it to the place, and then it just stay in the air for a few days near the house, near the Webb's open field.
If you wanted to fly a kite in Washington, D.C., I would suggest going over to the Washington Monument and stand in the fields.
But then it gets hooked on that big stone pointy thing.
That big obelisk. Those voices came from Lincoln, Nebraska, Concord, New Hampshire, and Washington, D.C.
Well, the U.S. has the world's largest prison population. 2.3 million Americans are currently behind bars. Well, what are their weekends like? They might be a bit more spiritual than those on the outside. 50% of prisoners regularly attend church, a higher percentage than the free population. Inside California's San Quentin State Prison, there are a lot of places to worship. There's church, synagogue, a mosque, and there's a special place right inside the facility that's called the San Quentin Indian Reservation. It's where American Indian inmates go every Saturday for a traditional sweat ceremony. Reporter Nancy Mullane takes us there.
On Saturday mornings, as soon as their cell doors are opened, a dozen Indians make their way across the prison yard as speakers blare overhead. The men wear prison blue shirts and jeans, a telltale sign they're lifers. They walk past razor wire and heavily armed guards and make a beeline for the Indian reservation. It's a 2,500-square-foot fenced-in oasis on the edge of the yard, filled with fruit trees, flowers, and herbs, all planted and cared for by the Indians.
You know, have the roses and the different trees, the grass, and everything has meaning.
Before slipping between gates separating the reservation from the teeming prison population on the yard, Robin Guillen, a Chippewa and Comanche Indian, lights a bundle of sage at the bottom of a conch shell and bathes himself in the smoke. This is called smudging.
When you smudge off, what you're doing is getting rid of those negative things that you may bring into this sacred area that should not be here.
35 years ago, Robin was convicted of first-degree murder. The reservation is one place where his crime doesn't define him. Today, he's the spiritual leader of a religious ceremony called a sweat.
This first ancestor that I will lay here represents our Earth Mother.
Before the sweat can begin, rocks representing ancestors have to be fired so they can heat the inside of the lodge. One by one, Robin selects rocks from a pile and places them in a fire pit. He then starts a fire with wood from the prison's furniture factory. For 2 hours, while they wait for the rocks to heat up, Indians sit under the reservation's trees on the cool grass. It's easy to forget the prison yard is just a few feet away. Until the guards call for a prisoner over the loudspeakers. This place has a tenuous relationship with the prison that surrounds it. Guards can enter at any time, and the warden decides whether or not they can still use tobacco, a traditional part of their sacred ceremonies. Now tobacco is seen as a violation of the prison's new anti-smoking policy.
They stop selling tobacco, they stop letting tobacco come in, and when it run out, it run out. Now, if you get caught with it, they write you up.
Jasper Alford, a Karuk Indian, is serving a 25-to-life sentence based on the three strikes law. Even without tobacco, he says participating in sweats and other reservation ceremonies helps him transition from feeling like a criminal to feeling like a human being.
This is one of the few places that we can come in San Quentin where they have enough respect for our religion and our culture to allow us to practice our ways, to sing, to dance, to drum, to sweat.
When the rocks have turned fire white, inmates take off their prison blues, wearing only white boxer shorts. They get down on their hands and knees and crawl into the sweat lodge.
Oh, all related.
Two fire tenders bring the first of the burning hot rocks to the lodge.
Oh, we got one more.
Oh, a strong one.
The opening flap is closed. Inside, mint-infused water is poured onto the top of the rocks. The temperature inside jumps to over 150 degrees, thanks to steam that rises from the rocks.
They call that grandfather's breath, because he's taking your strength, taking all the impurities out of your body and offering them up to Mother Earth so that Mother Earth can put them somewhere where they don't hurt no one.
First time I ever met my dad was in here in this sweat.
Dwayne Garcia is a White Mountain Apache. Today, he's a fire tender. He'll be getting out of prison in a few weeks. He says it was in the dark of an earlier sweat. He asked the others to pray for the imprisoned father he'd never met, Danny Garcia.
Yeah, I was inside, and I was praying, and I said, you know, I'd like to pray for my father out there. He's ailing, you know, and my dad, first time I ever met him, was sitting right across from me. He goes, thank you. Not a good thing, but hey, I met my dad.
Strong, brother. Thank you.
Each sweat lasts 2 hours. After the men finish the last of their prayers, they crawl back out of the lodge.
Come on. You okay? You make it?
Slowly, they stand and look up to the sky. Their bodies drip with sweat. Their white boxer shorts are covered in a reddish-brown mud, but their eyes are sharp. Frank Gomes, a Yurok and Pomo Indian, uses a cold water hose to wash off the mud.
Like being reborn. Literally.
Now clean, the men put their prison blues back on. The fire is put out. Robin Guillen picks up a flutie card and plays for his mother, who recently passed away.
This song is in honor of my mother, Patricia Ann.
The prison bells ring out. It's time for all inmates to return to their cells for the day's headcount. The Indians leave the reservation and walk back across the yard. I'm Nancy Mullane for Weekend America.
There's an amazing multimedia slideshow of the prisoners preparing their sweat lodge, you know, going in and observing their worship. Go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
This is Weekend America. Let's say you are planning an outdoor party this weekend or a backyard barbecue. Everything is in place, and then the unwanted guests arrive. Oh, no. The dipterous members of the family, Culicidae. You hate those guys. Well, so does Weekend America's John Moe. So he met up with an expert on mosquitoes. Mike McLean works for the Metropolitan Mosquito Control District in the Twin Cities. To help John get to know his enemy, Mike took him to an infested pond near Lake Phalen in St. Paul for a little skeeter primer.
This site is actually fairly healthy, and there's a lot of things going on in it. There's tadpoles, for one thing. There's some dragonfly nymphs and things that are going to eat some of those larvae. But if you look at the edge of this pond, it's dry. But there's millions of mosquito eggs sitting here waiting for this pond to stretch out and cover them.
And then how does it work with the eggs? Like, how long are the eggs just sitting there?
The eggs will sit there for 7 years or maybe longer before they're flooded with water. So they're really well able to withstand drought. If you go through several years of really dry weather, there's a lot of mosquito eggs that are viable. And what happens is you get a lot of rainfall in the summer, and you can get 3 or 4 years worth of mosquitoes all hatching at once.
Can you arrange some sort of aerial DEET bombing to stop this from happening, Mike?
That would be tough. Although when the mosquitoes are in the water, we contract with 7 helicopters that put a bacterium in the water. So the bacteria kind of forms a little crystal in their midgut and tears them up from the inside out.
Yeah.
So, yes.
So we've got a little bit of germ warfare going on.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Biological controls.
Now, I've been fighting mosquitoes since I was a kid using a method I like to call slap my arm and cuss a lot.
Yes.
I assume that...
A tried and true method.
That, yeah. You fancy people with your fancy technologies have had more breakthroughs than that. What is the cutting edge in mosquito combat?
Well, you know, for personal protection, you can't beat a mosquito repellent that has DEET in it. That's still the tried and true. It's been around for, you know, 40 or 50 years and does a great job. You know, mosquitoes are attracted to dark colors. They're looking for a dark shape that's moving around in the evening. And if you wear something dark, they're going to find you a little faster than if you wear white or light-colored clothing. So we always say light-colored clothing, a long sleeve for obvious reasons. So, you know, the more barrier you put there, the less problems you're going to have. And then loose-fitting. A mosquito's proboscis can actually bite through a T-shirt that's a little too tight. You know, so you want to wear long, light, and loose. Those are the 3 L's. That's without the repellents.
And why also, as long as I have you here, when you're sleeping and they go into your ear and scream?
Yes.
Why do they do that?
Well, their wings actually give off a sound at a certain frequency, and a lot of times those wing beats serve as a way of attracting a mate. So when they're flying
around... Are they
looking
for mates in my ears?
It could be. It could be. But I kind of doubt that. Each species has a wing beat that's of a certain frequency, and that's how they get together. That's how they don't confuse themselves one with another.
Realistically, you know, we're not going to wipe these things out. How close can we hope to get to never being bit?
You know, you really have to learn to live with them to a certain extent. If we can keep the level down to where the average person can just... enjoy themselves, you know, maybe a couple of swats here and there, then we're doing our job.
That's Mike McLean with the Metropolitan Mosquito Control District for the Twin Cities. Remember those many, many, many dormant mosquito eggs he told us about lying at the dry edge of the pond? Well, this weekend, it's raining in the Twin Cities, so Mike is girding for battle. Yes, this is Weekend America.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat.
Coming up, one family takes to the road as they drive across America. Too bad they can't risk getting out of the car. That's next on Weekend America.
Thank you.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. This summer, we've been bringing you our summer travel series, stories about discovering America the old-fashioned way, the road trip. I'm a military brat. My family crisscrossed this nation often in the summer times as we went from bases in Colorado, New Mexico, Florida, to my parents' home in Virginia. Now, mostly we made those trips in our two-tone green 1954 Buick Special. My dad loved the chrome on that car. It was the first new car he ever owned.
To get in it and drive off the lot was like, wow. You know, this is my car, and it's smooth and good ride, and roll all of the windows down. It was just like a convertible, you know. So it was cool.
On those trips, I remember my brother Bill and I playing I Spy with the license plates, my father pointing down the cliffs in West Virginia, the oil wells in Texas, or the rushing Mississippi, and saying to my brother, son, that's a dangerous thing. My father seemed to love those trips more than any of us.
Driving is moving in a sense of comfort, security, and carefreeness. I mean, you're in this car and you're just going, there ain't nothing else. If you leave early in the morning at the break of dawn, that's the best time. Everything is sleeping and just beginning to wake up. You see a car here and you see a light over here, but there's a sense of peace and tranquility over the whole city.
But it wasn't always peace and tranquility. We were a black family, often navigating the South in the mid-60s.
Now, there were some logistical problems associated with traveling for black people.
It's just like my dad to call racial segregation a logistical problem. It was much more than that. Driving across the country meant going without some basic necessities.
Sleeping, you slept in the car. I would sleep sitting in the front seat, and Barbara would too.
But what about using the bathroom or getting a shower? Like, how do you prepare for that?
You don't. You don't get a shower. And, you know, push come to shove, you go into the colored bathroom. That's your choice. Unless you get fed up and you go down the road another 20, 30 miles until you come to a rest area and you find a way to use the bathroom or you find a way to wash your face.
Now, both of my parents had grown up with segregation, but it was another thing entirely to have to drive through towns where you had no way to know who was friendly and who wasn't.
A savvy traveler would have a copy of the Green Book for Motorists, which was the guidebook to hotels, restaurants, and other accommodations that were friendly to African-American travelers.
Thomas Agrew is a sociologist and historian. He's written about the car and race relations in America and about the touchy road etiquette for black drivers.
An African-American passed a white person, that could be perceived as a racial slight. The white person could get mad and hit the accelerator and give chase because that was a signal that you were insulting in some way.
There were times when we did take the risk and get a hotel for the night. Like in 1963, when we were driving through Louisiana. It was getting dark. My father saw a gas station beside a motel, and he pulled in.
And when I was pumping the gas, I looked in the window of that motel. Big sign says vacancies. And there was an attendant looking out the window. Well, when she caught my eye, she turned away. And before I could open that door, the vacancy sign had been turned around, no vacancies. But I went on in anyway and said, I want to get a room. And she said, well, we don't have any vacancies. I said, the sign just said you had vacancies. You just turned it around. And she said, well, we still don't have any vacancies. And I just turned around and left. I was wearing a uniform. I always traveled in the United States Air Force uniform because that's going to give me an advantage. They could see that I'm serving my country. And I thought that would be an advantage. But it was not an advantage.
How does a man remain a man when he's treated that way? My father kept his dignity by remembering his responsibility to the family and by getting back into the car.
When you encountered some of these things driving, what was it like to just be back in the car, to be back behind the wheel?
The security of the car gave you a sense of equality. You didn't worry about who was out there because you had your family. And as long as they are safe, the world is irrelevant.
But it wasn't irrelevant. It was real. I remember our last trip across the country. It was 1971. We stopped at a diner in Little Rock, and they didn't want to seat us. Our hot chocolate was tepid with hard marshmallows just floating on top. It was so humiliating, we left without eating our food. I asked my dad how he felt about that moment. How did he deal with it?
You are confronted with undesirable experiences, but you are already conditioned.
No. Because I remember shock and anger. You might have been conditioned, but this is probably one of the first times I remember, are we really going to be treated like this? Are you serious?
I was getting really angry. What I was trying to ask him was, why didn't he do something? I had seen him stand up for himself and for us 100 times before. Well, why didn't he do it then?
See, what normally would happen, your mother and I, we could create the atmosphere around us.
You know, he wouldn't give me the answer that I was looking for. Instead, he started talking about how he and Mom were always in control of the situation and of their feelings. And that's when I realized he wasn't trying to be a freedom fighter in those moments. He was there to look out for us. In his mind, he did do something. He kept us cool, and he got us out of there without incident.
What do you think Bill and I learned in the back seat of those road trips?
I think that you got a sense of togetherness, the sense of family, a sense of responsibility. You didn't get in that car and expect your mother to drive. You expected me to drive. And that was instilling in you the concept of what a father is supposed to do.
My dad is almost 74. His eyesight is failing in one eye. And yet this summer, he talked about driving from Virginia to New Orleans for a family reunion. I talked him out of it, made some plane reservations instead. You know, each time I do that now, I know I'm not just robbing my father of a leisurely road trip. I'm robbing him of the dignity he feels when he's behind the wheel. I'm robbing him of being my dad.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MBA Program.
Fire and falling water. Man takes on the elements from New York to California, coming up on Weekend America.
This is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. What is the soundtrack to your weekend? When you want to get into a space that's all your own, what music do you keep going back to? We've been asking you that for a goodly time now, and we have gotten so many stories set to many, many types of music. You can make yourself a mixtape just by going to weekendamerica.org. You can hear the entire weekend soundtrack collection there. Today's story comes from Pastor Thomas Biatek. He listens to us in Shorewood, Minnesota on KNOW. He's a minister there, and the soundtrack to his weekend is a hymn called Come, O Thou Traveler.
Come, O thou traveler unknown, whom still I hold but cannot see. My company before is gone, and I am left alone with thee. With thee all night I mean to stay, and wrestle till the break of day. With thee all night I mean to stay, and wrestle till the break of day.
Tom, why is this hymn your weekend soundtrack?
I fell in love with this hymn when I took a hike in Scotland. My church sang it as the last hymn before I took off on the trip. And it was my 40th birthday, and I wanted to treat myself, and I'm Scottish in heritage, and thought I'd hike the West Highland Trail, and had a disastrous, disastrous time. But this was the song I sang to myself as I hiked along.
What was the disaster?
It was me being stupid, basically. I hiked the first part of it, and I should have stopped in the town of Dremmen, but I thought I could keep going, and I kept hiking, and got caught in a horrible storm climbing a mountain, and ran out of food and ran out of water, and found myself utterly depressed and hurt and wet and soaked and cold, feeling just lost, completely lost. You know, the desperation in this song, talking about wrestling and fighting and worrying and wondering, just absolutely fit that trip. So it was a perfect moment and an imperfect trip.
Yield to me now, for I am weak but confident in self-despair. Speak to my heart in blessing, speak, be conquered by my instant prayer.
You know, that struggle of, you know, not knowing where you're going and then despairing because you don't have any direction. But then finding that actually even when you're lost, it has meaning. And even when you're struggling, that has meaning and that has purpose. That verse where the hymn makes it shift to understanding. You know, we're always struggling with love and we're always struggling to find our place. And that's the human condition. That's where we are and what we're supposed to be doing.
I hear thy whisper in my heart. The morning breaks, the shadows flee. Pure universal love thou art.
How is this hymn connected to your weekend?
In ministry, you do a lot of working with people, and you do a lot of leading groups and meeting with committees, and you're always involved with people. So when I get time off and I have a weekend, I don't work on Sundays, but on my Saturdays, it's time for me to be solitary. So I take very long bike rides, or I take long hikes, and I just try to find some peace and quiet with myself, and, you know, allow all the struggles and all the worries and everything to work itself out in my mind. And by the end of the day, I feel alive and energized and ready to go back into it.
Tom, thank you so much for sharing your weekend soundtrack with us.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to do it.
Pastor Tom Biatek's weekend soundtrack is Come, O Thou Traveler. By the way, he just got back from hiking the Lake Superior Trail, and he tells us this time he did remember to bring enough food and water. So what about you? What song is the soundtrack to your weekend, and what is the story behind it? Let us know the story at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And in St. Paul, I'm Desiree Cooper. Now, if you're walking this weekend along the East River in New York City, you might notice something different. Waterfalls. There are four of them as you head downstream. They range from 90 to 120 feet tall. They're made of more than 270 tons of scaffolding. And one is even under the Brooklyn Bridge. It's part of New York's largest public art project since Christo's Gates. That was 2 years ago in Central Park. At dawn on Thursday, the waterfalls just turned on. No crowds, no ribbon cutting. This weekend, a lot of people are taking them in for the very first time. And we wanted to get a taste of their reactions. But first, we spoke with the artist, Olafur Eliasson.
I wanted to integrate the water into the city. I didn't want to create a feeling that the waterfall just kind of flew in and was dropped on a neutral platform, just like a sculpture on a pedestal. So that's why I worked a bit with finding four different sites which would have a kind of a narrative or, you know, an individual story of a sort. The space around the lower Manhattan and that between Brooklyn, Manhattan and Governor's Island, that space has a kind of a history of sort of always being looked across. Nobody would sort of look at that space as a kind of a positive space. Everybody sort of looks at what's on the other side and takes it for granted almost. My name is Olafur Eliasson. I'm the artist who created the waterfalls here in New York. When I saw a boat going through the river, and when I looked at the water, essentially, I realized that one of the elements that would add depth to this space, one of the elements which would take it away from being a kind of a representation or a picture and make it actually, you know, three-dimensional, make it something which would take time to engage in, is the time it takes for the water to run. I look at it as a project, and a project is obviously like a dialogue. I say something, then the city says something back, then I say something or somebody else takes part in that dialogue. So I don't think that permanence or leaving the waterfalls up is necessarily any better.
My name is Philip Lopate. I'm a writer. I've lived in New York City all my life, born and raised here. From where I'm sitting, I could see one of the waterfalls extending from the roadway of the Brooklyn Bridge down into the bottom of the East River. New York City was founded because of the water, and it was really profoundly affected by being a great port. And then sometime in the 1960s, the port was transferred to New Jersey because of containerization. There used to be a kind of a superhighway of boats of all kinds going up and down the East River and the Hudson River, and now it's much more of an empty harbor with the occasional ferry or yacht or pleasure boat. New York City is a place of amazing created landscapes. After all, Central Park, which most people think of as a kind of a natural outcropping, was really entirely man-made. This city in general is the symbol of what man can do. And the bridges are part of that. So it really fits into the spirit of New York to have a man-made waterfall in its midst.
I think the idea is amazing. I'm Lauren Young. I'm from Brooklyn. And what's really cool this morning is that there's all this morning noise, so you're hearing the subways going across the Manhattan Bridge, and so I'm curious to come out at night and hear what it's like, because I think part of the whole experience is to hear the water. And this is the only place right now, we're standing at the foot of the Brooklyn Bridge, where you can hear it. The water is cascading down, but it's coming out of scaffolding. So it's not like it's coming out of these beautiful rocks or anything green. The thing is that we don't experience the water very much as New Yorkers, because it's highways pretty much all around the island of Manhattan. And I always get really angry. Why did they let this big city happen in the midst of an island? My husband likes to say that New York is a small island off the coast of the United States.
My name is Michael.
I think it's spectacular, but it's really does look fake, which it is. But it's a work of art. Definitely, it's a work of art, and I like it. I like it, but I'll give it a 6.
I might be in agreement with that. I would say I would give it a slightly higher mark, maybe a 7.75. I wouldn't ever jump in it, but I would definitely like being next to it. What would it take to get a 10? I don't know. I have to see it at night first. Everything looks better at night. Even people. And waterfalls.
I'm Adrian Palacios, and I'm from Brooklyn. You just never would imagine going over the bridge, like, seeing a waterfall in the river. The water's just there. I don't know how to describe it. Like, you just find yourself staring for a second instead of moving. You know, there's something else that you're looking at that's impressive, and it just stops you for a second.
The waterfalls will be running through October 13th. Now, if you can't get there to see them in person, check out the photos that we have at our website. It's at weekinamerica.org. The elements are making headlines all over the country this weekend. While New Yorkers are being awed by man-made waterfalls, residents of Winfield, Missouri are still trying to hold back the Mississippi. Levees broke on Friday.
And in Northern California this weekend, firefighters are calling on water. Lightning strikes have set off hundreds of wildfires threatening homes, power grids, and state parks. At the Langmuir Laboratory for Atmospheric Research in New Mexico, Ken Eck studies thunderstorms, so we asked him for some lightning insight. First of all, where does lightning come from?
That truly is our million-dollar question, or $64,000 question. We still don't fully understand how lightning gets started, how it travels between points in the cloud or even points from the cloud into the ground. We don't fully understand even how the storm itself gets charged up. We don't really fully understand the details of all that. You know, lightning is hotter than the surface of the sun, so its true color is always essentially a bright white as we perceive it. But when you see the different colors, it's entirely an effect of your eye getting a bright flash. If you're really close, you can actually hear the essentially the breakdown of air, and it sounds like ripping silk, or sometimes what I think is someone ripping a bunch of phone books next to your ear. It's almost a tearing sound.
These California fires have caused a lot of destruction. However, not all lightning is bad, and we want to share with you an example. Here is Lee Robinson telling you the story of his father. Now, Lee has had cancer, and his voice box was removed, so he now speaks with an electronic voice.
My name is Lee Robinson, and this story is about my father, Edwin Robinson.
I'm Bob Gustafson, and I'm the pastor at Emmaus Lutheran Church in Falmouth, Maine. And Edwin Robinson was a parishioner there when I first came in 1994. Ed was this remarkable story of someone who had had an accident in his truck and lost his sight and most of his hearing and suddenly had it restored.
He had adopted a chicken that somehow had found its way to him, and he had named the chicken Duck Duck because, well, as best he could make out, that's the sound that a chicken makes, duck, 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 and that's why he was out there, you know, he's walking around the garage, you know, calling duck, duck, and the birds inside the garage looking out at him, trying to figure out why he's out there standing in the rain during a severe thunderstorm.
I guess it was thundering and lightning and raining, and Ed was crawling around out in the backyard looking for Tuck Tuck on his hands and knees. Definitely found the bird and was struck by lightning.
The lightning bounced off the tree. It went directly into his hearing aids and blew the hearing aids right out of his ears. The connecting wire was burnt completely off. After my dad had been hit by lightning, he had laid on the ground for several minutes, and he finally got up. He went back in the house, and my mom came over to him because he looked, you know, dazed, and he said, "I think I've been hit by lightning." And she's kind of, yeah. And he said, no, really, I can read that plaque on the wall.
Began reading a plaque of some sort that was up on the wall that said something to the effect that God can't be everywhere. That's why he created grandparents. And his wife thought maybe he had just memorized that, but it turns out he was actually reading it.
So she said, yeah, that's, you already know what it says, so that doesn't mean a thing. How about looking at the clock over there on the wall and tell me what time it is? And he looked at the clock and he said it's 5:06, and he got his sight back to 20/20. He got his hearing back. All of his life he'd been completely bald, and several weeks later there was hair that started to grow on his head.
Not only was his eyesight restored and his hearing restored, but he started to grow hair again. It's hard not to say that it's not miraculous.
I think even if you talk to anybody else that's still around when this incident happened, that it was actually a miracle. I guess you could say there is a bit of luck in there, yes. Otherwise, he literally should have been killed by the lightning, yes.
Lee Robinson and Reverend Bob Gustafson telling the story of Edwin Robinson. Edwin passed away in 2001 with his vision, hearing, and a little bit of hair intact at the age of 83.
The weather won't provide much relief for the fires in Big Sur. It'll be partly cloudy there and in the low 70s. No rain this weekend. For more weather, here's Weekend America's John Moe.
The band Lynyrd Skynyrd took their name from Jacksonville, Florida gym teacher Lynyrd Skynyrd. It's Southern Rock Night at the Jacksonville Suns minor league baseball game, and Skynyrd throws out the first pitch amid thunder in 88. Sure, the band wrote Freebird, but Skynyrd made sure they could also whoop the Allman Brothers in dodgeball. The Francis Ethel Gum Festival just didn't sound right, so Grand Rapids, Minnesota goes with the stage name of their hometown girl for Judy Garland Festival with co-stars, family, and memorabilia. Thunder in 63, but no tornadoes sucking you up and sending you to a parallel universe of flying monkeys and dancing scarecrows. I guess that's just in Kansas. 74 degrees, thunder, and widespread alliteration as Cripple Creek, Colorado holds Donkey Derby Days. It's the 77th anniversary of the festival, featuring games, petting zoo, hopefully with animals more cheerful than donkeys, and the highlight, donkey races. It's like the Daytona 500 if the cars were prone to kicking people. I might watch more NASCAR if they did that. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
It's not every day you get to tell a gentle 97-year-old to go fly a kite, so take advantage. Stay tuned to Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where people can stay in touch with who they know and what they love. You can discover unsigned musicians, discuss books, share pictures, and keep up with the world. People are talking. Gather.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert. Mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at Calvert.com.
From American Public Media, thanks for sharing your weekend with us. You know, one of the things I used to love to do in the summertime was lie outside with my kids and watch the clouds go by. Reporter Chrissy Clark spent a recent weekend looking skyward. Here's why.
So one Saturday, I'm taking a walk along the beach in Santa Monica, and I happen to look up, and I see
a strange cluster of white birds flying in a perfect circle high up in the sky, around and around. They were way down the beach, and I hadn't planned to walk that far, but I couldn't help myself. What were they doing? Were they trained to fly like this? Were they circling a dead animal? The sand was soft. It took me a long time to get to the birds. As I approached, I saw that they were owls. I got closer, and I saw that each one was tied to a short string, which was attached to a single long one. My eyes followed the long string down hundreds of feet till I found what was at the other end.
My name is Tyrus Wong.
Tyrus Wong, or Ty for short, a small man in a beige fisherman's hat and a loose-knit sweater. He was standing at a slant, leaning back and looking up at the owls. He made them. They were kites. And how old are you?
I'm 97.
Ty learned kite making when he was a little boy in China. He lived there until he was 8. Then he and his father moved across the Pacific Ocean to America. His mother stayed behind.
Yeah. In fact, after I moved here, I never seen her.
But Tyrus never forgot her or the red, diamond-shaped kites that he flew when they lived together. Years later, after he retired, those kites grew into a life's passion. He's made hundreds since then. And for the last 30 years, on the fourth Saturday of every month, he flies them on the Santa Monica beach. Now his kites are much more elaborate, not simple diamond shapes, but animals, hand-painted, decorated with feathers or spinning bottle caps for eyes. He fills the sky with owls, swallows, rainbow-colored insects.
Centipedes and panda, two fish, 16 cranes, 25 butterfly.
That's a butterfly. Butterfly.
If all these critters sound like a scene from Bambi's forest, they should. Tyrus is actually the artist who painted a lot of Bambi's background landscapes for Disney in the 1930s. He liked the funny parts of the movie best.
What's that little rabbit?
Thumper!
You know, I think he's a wonderful character, you know?
Ty doesn't paint anymore. He says his hands shake too much. But he can still make kites.
Can I interest you guys in some pomegranate blueberry juice?
That's Kim, Tyrus's daughter. Every month she brings her dad and his truckload of kites to the beach. They lay out a picnic blanket and serve refreshments.
You want some, Dad?
Yeah. Family and friends stop by. The greeting is always a variation on a single theme.
Thank you for the wind today.
Or, did you bring the wind? If there is none. Tyrus and Kim welcome everybody, even strangers who stumble on their kite-flying party by accident.
Sometimes the seagulls come and investigate like they think it's another bird in their territory.
Once, after 9/11, a helicopter patrolling the beach took notice.
Finally, they called down to a policeman. He said this guy had too many kites up and too high.
Tyrus had to take the kites down that day. I've come back a few times since I first met Tyrus and Kim.
Hi. Yes, it's so nice to see you.
I see you too.
Did you bring some wind?
The last time I was there, it was a still, hot, sun-baked day. Tyrus gets a little restless when the wind isn't up. Now and then, he would pull a white handkerchief from his pocket and raise it in the air. It looked like he was surrendering, but he was doing kite calculations.
See the direction of the wind? Look, still, this has enough wind.
Finally, a light breeze. Tyrus jumps out of his beach chair.
Go ahead, Kim.
He grabs the kite string and points Kim towards a red goldfish kite.
Hey, no. Go ahead, further.
In position, feet apart, knees bent.
Okay.
The fish lunges up, then swerves down, head first into the sand.
Get him.
Now Ty's friends and family are watching from the picnic blanket. Each one has a look on their face like they're trying to will the kite into the air. Ty tries again, and the kite swoops up, then falls down, then dives.
Up, 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 go up.
Then it's floating, rising.
There it goes.
Huh? Where is it? Oh, up there.
One little girl, she goes to church with Ty's niece, watches in awe at the smiling man attached to a red fish swimming in the sky.
He's older than my great-grandma.
I tell you what, honey. You go over there and get a black one. Get the black one. Bring it over here. Okay.
Tyrus quickly dispatches her to get another kite.
The black one.
He doesn't want to miss his chance with the wind.
The black goldfish, okay? You try anything.
Then he and Kim put up a swallow, a 20-foot-long centipede, a panda with little legs dangling so that when the wind hits, it looks like it's running.
Here it goes.
running.
Oh, there it goes.
Once the kites are flying, Ty relaxes again, leans back on his heels, looks up, and starts flirting with the ladies who are also watching his kites bob up and down.
Yeah, how come that one is wiggling?
Oh, it's a female kite.
After Ty retired 30 years ago, he took up fishing for a while. That pastime also involved holding onto a line with an animal at the other end, gently tugging now and then. But before too long, Ty stopped fishing, went back to the kites of his childhood. It was better for you, Ty thought.
Well, fishing, you're looking down. Kite flying, you're looking up.
Maybe that's his secret for long life.
Yeah.
Let's go.
In Santa Monica, I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
What do you catch when you fly a kite?
Catch a cold.
Fly a kite up in the atmosphere where all the air is clear.
Tyrus is out flying kites this weekend in Santa Monica. If you can't be there with him on the beach, you can go to our website and see him and his magnificent kites. They're all at weekendamerica.org. You know, Tyrus has said that he always wanted to go to the World Kite Museum in Washington State. They have kites from all over Asia there, and they even show how kites have been used in everything from war to prayer.
I've been to that museum, and they also tell you kite stories, like how in the 1800s they were building a suspension bridge over the Niagara River, and a young boy flew a kite across the raging waters to help them establish the first line.
Wow.
We salute you, kites. That's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. You can download a free podcast of the entire program. Just go to weekendamerica.org. It's your weekend. Enjoy.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independence in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Sometimes weekends are for loading up the truck and moving.
So, this is the toilet. This here is your shower. This is called a dishwasher.
I'm John Moe. This weekend, a family of Burmese refugees is spending their first weekend in their new home.
And this is how you wash your dishes.
Welcoming refugees to America on the next Weekend America. Join us.